Members, we're going to get ourselves started here. This is the State Government Finance Committee. We have the minutes from March 19th and Representative Carlson.
So moved.
Move the minutes from March 19th. Any questions on the minutes? All those in favor of the March 19th, 2015 minutes for State Government Finance, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The minutes from March 19th are adopted. Members, we have a full slate of issues to address here this morning. Out of respect for the Attorney General, I'd like to start with her first. And she's just going to give us a brief overview of her budget. And we'll start you off. So if you can please state your name for the record. And
okay, very good. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I appreciate your time today. Thank you for having me. I know you have many priorities on your time and also on the state budget, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here today to talk about the Attorney General's office. Just briefly, the Attorney General's office represents, I think, over 100 state agencies, boards, and commissions. In any given year, we have over 7,000 open legal files. Those files run the gamut from major constitutional challenges to laws that you all have passed and promulgated to things like slip and falls on, you know, the Capitol steps. The litigation that we do is sophisticated. We routinely go up against the very biggest and best law firms and attorneys in not just the state of Minnesota, but in the country. And we defend the laws that you write against both constitutional challenges and legal challenges in very, very sophisticated areas. You might have read in the paper, we were in court last week, for example, on a challenge to the tax laws where some taxpayers want refunds from the state of Minnesota that altogether could total up to $700 million were they to prevail. So that's the kind of sophisticated litigation that we handle. We enforce the laws as well that you write. So if a state agency wants to bring an enforcement action or file a lawsuit, then the Attorney General's office represents them with an aim toward promoting and protecting the safety of Minnesota, the economic security of Minnesota, the health of Minnesota citizens. Those cases, again, can run the gamut. Just an example, we had a lawsuit we filed against a phone company that didn't pay fees into the 911 system. We have a 911 emergency system, and it's funded by fees. A phone company didn't pay. We filed a lawsuit and ultimately recovered $2.5 million through that lawsuit. And, you know, we protect the state's financial interests in court as well. It's no secret the state of Minnesota is viewed as a deep pocket by some litigants. People file lawsuits against it because they think they can get money from the state. And we defend those lawsuits and try to protect through that defense taxpayer resources. Example of that, the driver's license litigation. I think there have been some 39 lawsuits filed against the state of Minnesota for alleged invasions of the driver's license database. I think we have gotten the state dismissed from 39 lawsuits, 10 of which are on appeal. There were some public officials who estimated the exposure to the state could be hundreds of millions of dollars in that litigation, and thus far it's been zero through defending those 39 suits. We've been a good steward of taxpayer resources. I understand the need to prioritize and be efficient with taxpayer resources. I think in the late 1990s, there were over 250 attorneys in the office. Today, we have half that number. We have also managed the budget efficiently. In 2001, I think when you compare our general fund budget to what it is now, it's a reduction in inflation-adjusted dollars of about 42 or 43%, and in real dollars, over 20% a reduction in the general fund budget. And so we've done that by prioritizing, by being efficient, by avoiding mission creep, if you will. And today our budget's smaller than the budget of some of the county attorney's offices. So even though we're a whole state and we represent the interest of 87 counties, our budget's smaller than the metro area county attorney's offices. When you look at our budget, about 80% is personnel. About 10% are the things like leases and litigation software, and then about 10% is what you need to run a law firm. So all of the different costs of running a firm, from expert witnesses to mediators to legal process servers. And we deliver good bang for the buck, not just carrying forth the mission of the office and doing it well, but also returning money to the taxpayers. I think we typically return more to taxpayers to the general fund than we get out of the general fund. And when you look at the savings, that we get in just any number of these lawsuits, it is incredibly significant and many-fold exceeds the amount of appropriations given to our office. So that is it in a nutshell. I will be quick because I know you have a lot of demands on your time, but I appreciate the opportunity to be here and happy to take any questions.
Well, Madam Attorney General, we appreciate your energy. We're all dragging a little bit. We're here a little late.
You were
late
here
last
late last night.
So, Representative Lunan.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for coming this morning.
Thank you.
You know, you mentioned the driver's license issue,
yeah.
And I come from an insurance background.
Sure.
And there was always I had some confusion regarding that because I was under the understanding that a person's motor vehicle record or driver's license was public going back 60 months. Is that still the case?
You know, I'm not sure about that. I think in the litigation that's pending, essentially what the allegation is that various employees of not just state agencies but police departments and local cities sort of tapped into the driver's license itself, so not just the motor vehicle record, but actually looking up that physical driver's license. And there's two different elements of the driver's license. One is sort of what, and they're classified differently. One has to do with, you know, looking at the photo and things like that, and the other is, you know, looking at other aspects. So this isn't the motor vehicle record, it's the driver's license itself.
And the driver's license itself is not public. Excuse me.
Well,
Madam Attorney General.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Representative. So different aspects of the driver's license are treated differently. I think the photo has a higher protection than other aspects. The allegation in the case, essentially, against the state of Minnesota is that that the various commissioners of public safety didn't maintain sufficient controls over how state employees would tap into it. But federal law imposes liability on those who inappropriately use the driver's license, not upon the state itself. And that's how we've been able so far to defend the lawsuit. So some of those cases may remain pending against various employees of various government agencies, be it the state or a local law enforcement, for tapping into the database, if you will. But in terms of the state having liability for the conduct of the employees, thus far that's been dismissed.
Representative Lunan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And another to that point,
yeah,
is there's a bill regarding a license to drive for undocumented people, and some of the concerns people on both sides of the aisle have, that I'm assuming that court case or the findings of that and what that license can and can't be used for and what it can be accessed for will end up probably playing a role in that legislature going forward.
Madam Attorney General.
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm not familiar with that bill, but it could be, and I'd be happy to send you some of the court rulings, if you'd like, that we've gotten in those cases.
I appreciate that.
Okay. We'll send them to you.
Okay. Well, Madam Attorney General, appreciate you coming by today, and we'll be in touch if we have any further questions, okay?
Okay, very good.
Thanks
appreciate
for coming.
Your time. Thank you all so much.
You bet.
Have a good day.
We have... We'll do, Michelle, you want to, Ms. Timmons, you want to come up? Okay. Members, late in the, well, I wouldn't say late in the process, but at some point in the process, we were added an account, if you will, to our responsibilities. It's dealing with the rulemaking process and these getting the tracking of it all up to speed. That responsibility is with Ms. Timmons' office, and that is now under our purview for budgetary purposes. So, Ms. Timmons, if you could present, it is in your books, so if you have questions, too, about the details of it, you can find it in your budget books. With that, Ms. Timmons, if you could please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Yes, my name is Michelle Timmons, and I'm the reviser of statutes. I'd also like to indicate that Tim Orr, the deputy reviser for information services, is here with me. And Madam Chair, would you like me to focus primarily on the MARS system, the rule tracking system that's an expansion project?
No, you can do all.
Okay.
Just be mindful of the time that we have. We do have three bills yet to do today.
Sure. Okay. I I believe a handout is in the process of being passed out. And what I'd like to do first today is just talk a little bit about the many computer services that the revisor's office does provide for the entire legislature, not just the revisor's office, but the House, the Senate, the LCC, the Legislative Reference Library. So Tim Orr has prepared a really nice chart that's on, I guess, the third page of the handout. It's in the interior, that really shows you at a glance all of the computer services that the revisor's office provides. So, for example, the computer room in the basement of this building that holds all the revisor servers also holds servers for the House, the Senate, the LCC, the library. The revisor's office maintains that room. All the air conditioners, the fire suppression system, the maintenance in that room, that's provided by the revisor's office as a central IT service for the legislature. Similarly, VoIP telephones and the Wi-Fi systems, the core infrastructure and core networks for those systems that are used by the entire legislature, those core network services are provided by the revisor's office for the entire legislature. We've been a leader in virtualization of servers. We do that not just for the revisor's office, but for the LCC and the library as well. Then I think, you know, many of you are familiar with the entire bill drafting system. That's the revisor's system. So every time you see a bill, every time you see an amendment, a committee report, a conference committee report, a side-by-side, all of those documents are prepared using a specialized computer system that the revisor's office has developed and is now trying to maintain. Similarly, all the publishing, the session laws, the statutes, the administrative rules, the court rules, all of those materials that are on the website are produced using revisor computer systems. And on the back page of that chart that Tim prepared, you can see how popular our website is. The revisor pages are pretty seamlessly integrated with the entire Minnesota Legislature's website, but this chart that Tim has prepared really shows you how many hits we have on the revisor servers. And so in 2014, it was 298 million hits on revisor web servers to access those legal materials, and 4 million from additional hits from internal here to the legislature. That's what that little 4 is on top of that big bar graph. So you can see that the web focus has grown exponentially over the years, and it's really become the primary way that people access legal materials. And we have one programmer, one web programmer. So that all of that work and the central services are part of the reason why, you know, moving back to the request summary on the first page of the handout, we're asking for funding in two pieces. The first piece is really to maintain these core systems for the legislature. And we are asking for an addition of 5 computer staff. The detail is on the reverse side of that first page. One is a network administrator, because we have a single point of failure with all those Wi-Fi telephones. One is a style sheet programmer, because everything that comes out of the revisor system, whether it's on a page for a bill or on in a journal or whatever format, has to be styled. The second web programmer, a software tester to test all these software programs, and a business process modeler to to really bring us into electronic workflow and reduce the amount of paper that we use at the legislature. So in addition to that, the attorneys and production staff for the revisor's office are housed on the seventh floor of this building, the computer rooms in the basement of this building. But when the seventh floor was added on to this building during the 1985 remodeling, I think we maybe had three computer staff. So now there's no room for the computer staff on the seventh floor. They are housed in rental space over at Park Street. So at least on a temporary basis, we would need some additional rent. My hope is eventually we can move computer staff back into this building when all the moves have been made with the capital renovations. Also increased hardware and software maintenance, and actual computer hardware costs. So the total annual request for the base request is $594,600.
Ms. Timmons, I'm going to pause you right there.
Certainly.
Representative Kahn has a question.
Madam Chairman and members, has anyone ever suggested having a joint House and Senate technology staff?
Representative Kahn, I'm guessing you probably have.
Yes, I probably have. The answer is, has anyone else ever suggested that?
Mr. Shepherd, do you have an answer for that?
Madam Chair and Representative Kahn, it has been suggested in this committee a number of years. I don't know if it has ever been followed through sort of outside of the legislative realm here.
Representative Kahn.
Well, is there any way, if people are interested, is there any way we can put that on the table?
Well, I think maybe next year we can have more of an in-depth conversation.
I guess the one of the questions is, what do other states do?
Okay. Ms. Timmons, do you guys have any thoughts on that?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Kahn. I think that virtually every other state legislature has their own IT staff, because state legislatures have specific needs that are different from the executive branch or the court branch. And then within that question, I think, your more detailed question was, how are other states organized? And just like with most other state legislative services, it's a variety. I mean, I think some state legislatures do have a central legislative IT staff. Some have IT staffs that are perhaps more dispersed, as we do. What I will say, and I think what I was trying to say in some of the opening remarks that I made, is that you have a great deal of consolidation here already, frankly, in the revisor's office, in that core services that are needed by the House and the Senate and the revisor's office and LCC are provided now by the revisor's office. The legislative IT staffs have several groups that meet periodically on a regular basis and really try to cooperate so we're not duplicating efforts. So for the VoIP phones, for example, the revisor's office provides all the central network and central hardware, but specific requests for a new phone set or a new phone number, that's provided by House staff. So that we try to cooperate and work together efficiently.
Representative Kahn, any follow-up?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, the revisor's office is, of course, a perfect example of something which both are working together. And it just, I just think we should.
All right. Members, any other questions for Ms. Timmons? Ms. Timmons, any final comments?
Madam Chair, I guess I'd just like to wrap up by saying the second part of the request is really for this Minnesota Administrative Rule Status System, or MARS, And that is an expansion project that was included in the governor's recommendations. And it's really, I think, I don't know how much time you want me to spend on it, but on the reverse side, the second page of the handout, I've got three questions here. Why create an administrative rule status system? And I just point out the third bullet there, one of the major reasons would be to create a one-stop shop that would enhance legislative oversight of rulemaking. Why should the revisor's office design it? It's in part because thanks to a lot of work by revisor IT staff, Representative Erdahl coming to the rescue with the legacy grant, and a brainstorm by Paul Marinac, the chief deputy revisor, who is upstairs drafting as we speak. The revisor's office has a beta version of a rule tracking system already that we could build on. And the agencies loved that and then said, well, how much money would it take to create a full-blown system that will serve as the entire electronic rulemaking record? And so some of the money is one-time money for in fiscal year 16. That would be to build a prototype. Then there would be $855,000 in fiscal year 17 for the system build. Of that, $425,000 would be one-time, and $430,000 would be another base addition to the revisor's office to maintain the new MARS system. So that gives you just a very quick capsule summary of the MARS request, which is really separate or different piece from the base request.
Sure. Members, any questions? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Timmons, I know we talked last year about this MARS system, and I'm glad to see the governor put it in the budget, because part of our discussions last year, if I'm not mistaken, and if I remember it right, was not only would this help us as the legislature track all the rules that are being made, and that's a complaint we hear from members, but we also hear from the public, it would also help the public be able to track those rules as they're going through the rulemaking process, and would the term add transparency to the system so everyone would know what's going on. I mean, currently we have no way of doing that other than the beta system that they have developed for their internal use, but it's not, as the discussions we had last year about this, it's not robust enough, I guess is the term they use, to be able to let everybody use it around the state. So I mean, I think this would be a good expenditure for us to have, because it would increase our efficiency in the legislature.
Okay. Ms. Timmons, any comment to that or no?
I definitely agree. It's an extremely worthwhile project, because of the difficulty in maintaining the systems we have, we just aren't able to take it on without additional funding.
All right. With that, Ms. Timmons, thank you for coming and appreciate your insight on this. Members, we have House File 472, Representative Erickson's bill. Welcome to the committee, Representative Erickson. I'm going to move House File 472. We have two other bills on the docket, too, that we want to make sure that we have enough time for. So if you want to introduce your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Sandra Erickson, and I'm here to present today House File 472, which is a request for an appropriation from the general fund for a nonprofit that deals very definitely with those who need assistive technology, and because they have access then to this assistive technology, they can proceed to get a job or continue in their job that they may already have. but they rely on this, and this nonprofit is requesting an appropriation to help them with that part of our population. So with me, Representative Anderson, is Carol Fury, who is a part of Equipalife, which is one of the assistive technology organizations in the state that's a nonprofit and has done some very good work. So I think she's ready to testify to this bill.
Ms. Fury, if you want to state your name for the record and who you represent.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Carol Fury Fisman, and I am the CEO of Equipalife, which is a statewide nonprofit organization dedicated exclusively to the issues of access to assistive technology, devices, and services that help people with disabilities and our aging population to work, live, and play in the communities of their choice. In 2003, we were awarded two federal grants that started out two separate low-interest loan programs. In that year, it was the last year that there was federal funding available for this initiative, so Minnesota was very lucky to actually get in on the federal money to start the program. We came to the legislature because back in 2004 because we had to raise a match to bring down $2.7 million in total. Legislature, we're sitting here with Sandra back then. I have a little picture sitting here by Sandra, a reminder of us sitting here several years ago, asking the legislature for a small amount of money to get this program going. Since that time, we've had the microloan, which helps people purchase adaptive equipment through a low-interest loan, and the telework program, which focuses exclusively on employment and does not have to include adaptive equipment. It can be anything a person needs in order to work. We've been very successful in building a program that reaches out to all areas of the state. We have supported $6.6 million in low-interest loans throughout the course of the last 9 years. With a zero default rate. Madam Chair, members of the committee, there's not an institution of lending in this country that can give you that figure, having a zero interest rate. And we accomplish that by working individually with the people that we serve. At this point in time, we are raising new capital because the demand has outweighed what we have as a supply for funding. We have continued to build on the original funds that we received. However, we have used some of it for operating expenses, and primarily in the beginning as we got started. The last 3 years we've worked on our sustainability plan to rely less on any funds from the loan program so that we can dedicate them exclusively to individuals in need. We have expanded our program from one lending partner to three so that individuals can basically go anywhere in the state and meet with someone who's in our lending system. We also have improved our products. Currently, our interest rate is 4.25, and we have a guarantee, which is part of the issue that brings us here today, in that we're raising $4 million. We're asking the state for one half. The economic impact that comes back to the state as a result of your investment is very difficult to measure, but I'll just give you a few examples. Individuals who work spend their money in their local community. They pay taxes. They interact in their communities, volunteer, own homes, and have a career. Instead of a job, putting widgets in a box. We have been number one in the nation in our program for access to telework, and we're very proud of it. Our outcomes have been tremendous. The individuals that we have served in our employment program, one at a time, very slowly, have been successful and are now off of public service. Some of them are completely off of public services, and have been off of public services for like 4 to 5 years. So they have sustained the test of time. This investment, one-time request, will allow us to continue this program into perpetuity. And I just have one thing I'd like to show you before there's any questions. I brought along a little prop. In this box are some of the applications that are waiting right now to be funded. There's 42 in here. Without new money at this point in time, we've had to put people on a waiting list. One of the people who's on our list to testify this morning, Roger Robinson, who is a person who has used our loan program, was unable to bank it due to transportation issues because his van needs repairs. And he's come back to the loan program for assistance.
Ms. Fury, we do have some questions. Representative Kahn?
The first question is this the only organization in the state who does this, or are there others?
Ms. Fury?
Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, we are the only organization in Minnesota that provides low-interest loans to individuals with disabilities for the purchase of adaptive equipment and employment-related equipment.
Representative Kahn?
Is there any other way of supplying the equipment other than a loan? Is there anyone who does anything else in this program? Just instead of thinking of exactly what you do, we're just thinking of the result of getting disabled people more integrated. And is there any other group that does this?
Ms. Fury?
Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, yes, there are many other alternatives, and that's part of what EquipaLife has been doing over the last 9 years, is to develop alternatives to the loan program. We have a reuse program that we partner with various organizations to bring in slightly used equipment and bring this into the hands of individuals who cannot afford a loan. We actually have a stair lift for one person that has been installed in 3 different homes that was purchased with a grant that we helped people receive from a local foundation. We have put together a resource manual of different financial resources beyond the loan. So the loan is not the only option for people. We work in tandem with other organizations that have lending and demonstration libraries to get equipment into people's hands for trial so that they have an opportunity to try things out and instead of buying the wrong item. We also have a lending program, and we spearhead a statewide collaborative of agencies that which we provide training to help ensure that there are access to specialists throughout the state who can help. There, Representative Kahn and Madam Chair, there really are very, very few resources for people, especially individuals who need a guarantee or who need a special grant. We were also awarded, Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, we were awarded an $85,000 one-time individual donor grant about 4 months ago to start our own individual grant program. So we've been doing many different things with many partners throughout the state. We work with the schools. We work with adult programs. We work with educational systems. We work with group homes and day programs and nursing homes, assisted livings, anyone in need.
Representative Kahn?
Is there any possibility of whatever appropriation we make for this, making it as a matching grant appropriation, that the money doesn't come unless there's equal funding coming from private sources or other sources of government or something?
Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, there is a possibility of doing that. We have an application into Rehab Services the United States Rehab Services Administration, and we are awaiting a response on that, and that is a grant for $668,500. So that's a quite a large amount, almost $700,000.
Representative Khan?
Well, one of my experience has been, in terms of doing things, is that the matching grant becomes a very effective way of maximizing an appropriation. Both the state is happy to give money when they see it's bringing money in from the outside, and both people making contributions. Well, we all know from all the solicitations we get from charitable organizations, you know, a donor has put out this money, and if you contribute, you'll double. You know, it's clearly people who know how to raise money have discovered this is a very effective way to do one. So I would like us to look at this, maybe for this, for anything like this.
All right. You do have a list of Representative Erickson, a couple other people. I see that we have David Zipperman, who is the chair of Equip Life, and then we have Christopher Wayne and Tom Peterson. I don't know if they are intending to testify at all. That would be something unique that hasn't been said already. So, Representative Erickson, or are you good to go?
Madam Chair, if they have something unique to say, I did want to remind Representative Khan and members that I know we both served on state government finance when Representative Krinke chaired it, and we made the first grant to Equipalife, and that was done at a matching. And you may recall that, Representative Khan, that we required a match on that. But Representative Anderson and committee, I'm not sure. Is there something new that can be said, Ms. Fury, that we haven't already said? Because I know they have lots to do, and I also have a committee that is waiting.
And is there anyone else from the audience that wishes to speak to this bill?
We do have our chairperson here. Mr. Zimmerman, would you like to speak for one moment? He did drive in from New Ulm for the meeting
definitely.
This morning.
You want to come up to the testifier table?
Madam Chair, members, do you have any other questions for me?
I do, but I'm going to wait. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and who you represent.
My name is David Zimmerman. I represent, I'm chairman of the Agribility, Equipalife. Sorry. Agribility was a program of Equipalife, too. I'm a farmer. I've been in a chair since 1986. I was involved in a motorcycle car accident. Just a little history or bio on me. I spent 8 months in St. Mary's Hospital. Before that, I was a farmer and full-time truck driver. But at that time, there was nobody that helped me. You know, we had a little book from Purdue University that had ideas of things that were welded and torched and cut together and metal all put together. I didn't have nobody. That's what we did on our farm. So that's what we did. It was not safe. It was all winches that pulled it up. Since then, I was able to get a hold of some equipment that was professionally built and was more of a standardized and it would be very safe. And I come from that background of farming and stuff. Since then, I farm with my two brothers and my wife. So in my situation, if I wasn't there, the whole situation would not be running, you know what I mean? Because the farming aspect is more of a family farm, even though a lot of us do work off the farm. We're not a big multi-million-dollar farming operation and stuff like that. And people like back then, like now, there is places that you can know where to go, and Equipalife is a place to go for somebody to go. Where do we get our hands to touch on or to know where to go to find this equipment that is available? And the people that build this equipment are people that are in wheelchairs and stuff. And there are very, you know, very smart and very intelligent people. And when I was involved in Equipalife, I was on the initial state agency that did start Equipalife back 10 years ago when it was decided on that the STAR program might sunset. So that in this it started this program. So it is a state started operation. So, and you can see our needs are great. And in my line of field, I heard that OAS, National Agribility, they have a conference every year, once a year. And they said every dollar that gets spent on somebody that improves their life or can contribute back to their employment or life turns over 11 times. That's the quote I have received. Okay. So if there's any other questions
Mr.
for me.
Mr. Zimmerman, we have some folks that have some questions for you, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the testifiers. Have you reached out to any veterans organizations, the CVSOs from the counties and so forth, and just check to see if any contacts have been made with the veterans organizations?
That's a
Mr.
very good...
Mr. Zimmerman?
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, you can.
Madam Chair, I'd like to take the question. Madam Chair, Representative...
Ms. Fury?
Yes, we have reached out. We actually have a partnership with the outreach program for the Veterans Administration. There are 11 outreach sites throughout the state. We work with that, with those individuals, returning veterans and veterans in need of equipment and other resources. We recently assisted an individual who was a homeless person with a disability who was a veteran. We also work with the Veterans Administration statewide on their reuse program, which has been extremely effective.
Representative Detmer.
Thank you.
Representative Kahn.
Well, just a slightly peripheral question to your testimony. Were you wearing a helmet when you had your motorcycle accident?
Yes, ma'am. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here.
Okay.
I got thrown. Mr. I went Zimmer. Through an intersection. I was T-boned by a lady in an intersection. I got thrown about 120 feet.
Wow.
I had a compound fracture in my back, a compression fracture in my back, and my right tibia was broken through, so it snapped in two, and my right wrist was as bad as they said I could have stuck a piece of dynamite under it or let a semi run over it.
Well,
because I have to say this, the doctor that put my wrist together was very angry with me, and he was a Vietnam surgeon. And when he looked at my x-rays, he said, my x-rays look so terrible that I should have to have it made so it's stiff. Or he said, you can put a prosthetic on it, and you can see how well it. The only thing I don't have is the back flexion and this. Otherwise, there's rods, and, I mean, it was in there for 60 months.
Yeah. Well, just the point, it probably would have been much worse if you didn't have a helmet on. So.
Yeah, I wouldn't be here.
Yes.
Ms. Fury, I just have some questions for you. This bill is traveling in the Senate. They have the money coming out of DEED. Where are you at on figuring that out? Is it admin or DEED?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this started out, the program did start out through the Department of Administration, the STAR, which is houses the STAR program, and they are responsible for funds that come from the federal government, a small amount of money every year. And one of the tasks within the parameters of that act is what's referred to as alternative financing. We have fulfilled that role with the money from the federal government for the past, since 2004. And we did have that matching grant where we raised the remaining amount. We had to raise $550,000. DEED is a home for it long term, as the U.S. Department of Education is moving all of those core services of DEED, which include the work that we do to impact people living independently and for employment purposes, over to Health and Human Services in the month of April. However, I know that administration would like to see it remain there, and we really do not have any problem with what the committees decide. For oversight purposes, it would probably make better sense to have it in admin because they are familiar with it.
Ms. Fury, what tell me what your overhead costs are. In general, how much of these funds would go towards administrative costs?
Our average overhead cost is less than 4%. This money actually would go into the permanent separate account, and the only reason that we would use any of it for operating is if it was absolutely necessary. And I was referring earlier to the last 3 years building our sustainability plan. We now have 4 individual contracts that pay us fees for services on a regular basis for providing assessments, and that is the result of the new DHS rate system. So that has brought in brand new income that we worked very hard on. We are single source award contractors for the home modification project, and we are single source on the alternative finance.
Ms. Fury, what's your overall budget, and how much of your budget is spent on administrative costs? Maybe that
4% or less.
And what's your overall budget?
Our overall budget is $375,000.
So the original loan money that you have, where is that?
Most of it is tied. Excuse me, Madam Chair, members. Most of it is tied right now to loan guarantees. A portion of it, about $800,000 over the last 10 years, has been used for operational costs to get the program running and to provide rescue payments for individuals, which allows them to repay us at the end of their loan cycle. And that money does come back into the program.
I think what might be helpful is just a greater detailing of the finances of your operation. So if you can provide that to us at some point, I think that would be helpful. I've got Representative Schultz has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned that your low interest rate is 4.some%. How do you arrive at that rate?
Ms. Fury?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we work in tandem with our lending partners. And the first item that we negotiate is the preferred or lower interest rate. So it is a negotiating process between the lender and Equipalive. Currently, we're at a fixed rate of 4.25 with lender A. I'm not sure if I should actually use the names of the lenders or not. And lender B is at 4.5, and lender C requires 100% guarantee. Lender A has also provided us with a new product for our program, which allows us to decrease the amount of dollars that we need to set aside for the guarantee by 0.25 basis points on an annual basis for each loan that has been in good standing for 1 year.
Representative Schultz?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And are there federal guidelines for setting of the rate?
Ms. Fury?
Madam Chair, Representative, at this particular point, because this is not federal funds, we would follow the guidelines that were initially established, because we would want to remain a part of the federal program. So yes, the answer is yes.
Thank you.
Members, seeing no other questions, I'm going to renew Representative Earhart.
Thank you. Madam Chair, how does your loan situation work? Are you actually lending the money and then, or you have a lending institution and you're supporting it somehow?
Ms. Fury?
Madam Chair, Representative Earhart, we are sort of the quasi-underwriters. We do all of the legwork to find out the information, to gather the data from the individual and a co-borrower. Many times we have co-borrowers. We gather all the information together, and in partnership with our lender, the lender actually does the lending. So we have our funds in a permanent separate account in that lending institution, specifically for the microloan and specifically for access to telework. So we have about 15 accounts right now.
Madam Chair, another question. Well, it probably doesn't make any difference, so I give up on that one.
Could I just give one?
Very briefly.
Because we have two more bills yet to go, and we have about, you know.
I got less 30 seconds.
Okay, great.
Okay, so we usually had loan meetings like once a month.
Mm-hmm.
We usually have like 3 to 4 loans on that docket or whatever, and we'll spend up to 2 hours on 3 to 4 loans just to dissect them to make sure that they are feasibly right and not something that they don't need, trying to find them different avenues of it's not just, okay, I need $5,000 for this. We really go through them, and if you spend an hour and a half to 2 hours for 3 to 4 loans on the phone, that's a long time holding your hand up with your phone here. So that's just my take, madam.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, David.
Members, with that, I'm going to renew my motion that House File 472 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus State Government Finance Bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, yep. Members.
Representative Rumbeck, we have House File 1835. Representative Rumbeck, I'm going to move that House File 1835 be referred to the Environment Finance Committee. We still have one bill left after yours, so hopefully we can get through it quickly. Representative Rumbeck,
you.
If you just want to briefly explain your bill.
Thank you, members. Other than the fact that there is a small appropriation requested to the Met Council, I guess we weren't certain what we are to address in the committee here, but I'll just briefly describe what we have in House File 1835. Really, the focus of it is water planning, really from the municipality's point of view. And as we're all aware, there's more and more interest in this expanding area of government. And the bill typically clarifies and consolidates the roles of various water planning authorities, so that there is more clarity for municipalities as they go about their planning and their comp plans that are coming up for renewal. So the pieces of the bill, and I would request that you take a look at the little diagram in the packet. I think that really defines what's happening here. So we are clarifying and consolidating roles. We are codifying a tech advisory committee that is involved with the MOSAC, the Metropolitan Area Water Supply Advisory Council. We are requiring that the policy actions taken by the policy committee are subject to a vote. And we are inserting the legislature in the process through the Legislative Water Commission, so that as mandates that affect cities and affect the whole region will have to come before the Legislative Water Commission. So there is elected an opportunity for elected officials to have a role. And I think that's essentially what we're doing. It does impact the implementation date of the DNR's Northeast Groundwater Management Area Plan as well. So that would be suspended until the policy folks have more opportunity to hear the technical side and to keep the technical and engineering and science side of the planning in sync with the policy. And I think that's the big key here. And I have worked, by the way, with the League of Minnesota Cities, Metro Cities, Met Council, and the DNR, and they are all good with this bill.
Representative Johnson.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Rebecca, do you know how much you're requesting?
The figure of $1 million was suggested. And we might want to get a more specific idea from the Met Council as to what the need actually is and what the dollar figure really would be. But I suspect it's close to that. It has been a fairly underfunded planning entity, the MOSAC. And so this would give them an opportunity to have a separate funding stream.
Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, do you know which target that money would come from? Are you thinking from this account or?
Representative Johnson, we've just been having that conversation. I do believe that would come out of the transportation target.
Transportation?
Yep. So this has to go to Environment Finance, and then it also needs to go to transportation, too.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep. Members, any other questions on the bill? Representative Earhart.
Madam Chair, is this a brand new...
Representative Earhart, can you use your microphone, please? Thank you.
Is this a brand new unit of government that's being set up, or does it already exist and we're just funding it?
Representative
Madam Rutherford. Chair and Representative Earhart, the Metropolitan Area Water Supply, MOSAC, committee is existing currently in the Met Council. This is a little bit more formalized with how the technical committee would have input to it, but essentially we're sort of temporarily pulling it out from Met Council and having it report up as far as policy goes to the Legislative Water Commission. So it exists. The technical advisory committee actually exists too, but it's really not in statute. This gives a bit more definition to that whole process.
Representative Earhart.
Madam Chair, has it always been funded like this in the same amount that it is now?
Representative Runnebeck.
Madam Chair, perhaps Jason Willett from Met Council would be able to describe that.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm Jason Willett. I'm the Finance and Energy Director for MCES. That's the Environmental Services Division of the Council. Probably mostly know us for our wastewater utility functions. This water supply planning authority has been in statute for a number of years. It has never had a funding source, and we've sort of just kludged together various things, some leftover bond proceeds you allowed us to use several years ago. Some of the activities have been funded out of Clean Water Fund appropriations, and so forth. And so what we're seeking is a permanent funding source to be able to provide technical and administrative resources for this broader consensus that we think will work, that will hopefully let us all agree on water supply planning for the future.
Representative Earhart.
Madam Chair, when you say the money comes out of transportation, we're talking about the gas tax here then, or another source of drainage, or what?
Representative Rembeck?
Madam Chair, I don't know if I'm clear on that either.
Mr. Willett?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure where that language about transportation came from. We are actually hoping to work with the cities to identify a fee structure that would work so that the cities could authorize us to charge them. Some of the work that we do provides a real economy of scale for them. For instance, we have done a modeling and conservation toolkit. It costs us about $400,000. 40 cities are using that now. It would have cost at least $100,000 each, so $4 million if they'd done that individually. And in addition, we get the benefit of using common assumptions, which is a big deal, so we don't have to repeat all of this stuff.
Representative Earhart.
Well, Madam Chair, the reason I ask that is because we've got $200 million a year, or $400 million a biennium coming out of the highway user trust fund, and I thought, well, gee whiz, this is a steady source where somebody can bring their cup over and get it filled up, and we're talking water, so that's easy. Fill up your cup with water and get paid by the gas tax, if that's what we're doing. Well, that's why I'm curious about where the funding is coming from.
Representative Earhart, I think you raise a good point. Representative Brunbeck, it sounds like you're kind of working out that mechanism. I have concerns, obviously, with charging back fees to our communities and what that means overall. So I'm hopeful you have a couple more stops to go. I'm assuming that you'll be working on that and have a better answer for us down the road.
Right, that is the plan, Madam Chair.
Okay. Members, is there anyone else from the audience that wishes to speak to this bill? Mr. Meyer, please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Madam Chair, members of the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. We have been in discussions with the author on this bill, and we do have one concern. The language that's on lines 5.7 to 5.8 that will prohibit any expending resources to plan or prepare for a regional water surface connection puts us in a direct conflict with a mediated settlement that we have with the lawsuit that the department has been faced with. from the White Bear Lake residents in the area surrounding White Bear Lake. Part of that mediated settlement that we have requires the DNR to support a legislative proposal advanced by a public entity to fully fund the feasibility and design of Phase 1 system by August 2016. This language in this bill puts us in direct conflict with that settlement agreement and will bring us back into court. Thank you.
Representative Rumpf.
And Madam Chair, and we've spoken, and that language does not appear to impede what we need to do. I mean, it's not something that's necessary for the bill, so we will be providing an amendment to delete that.
Great. Members, any other comments to the bill? All right. Seeing none, I renew my motion that House File 1835 be referred to the Environment Finance Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Your bill is on its way.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee.
You're welcome. We have Ms. Peggy. Next on the docket, we have House File 327. Representative Albright, you want to present this bill until Representative Scott gets here? Members, while we're waiting for Representative Scott to get here, too, Ms. Roberts, do you want to walk us through the fiscal note?
Madam Chair and members, the fiscal note in front of you is sort of the standard fiscal note that we get for constitutional amendments. And you'll see showing on the front page is the state cost of estimated at $2,000 for programming costs at the Secretary of State's office. And in the past, whenever we've had constitutional amendments, the office has agreed to absorb those costs. But they do like to illustrate what they are. But as you may know, the real costs of putting a constitutional amendment on the ballot are the costs to the local governments. And those are outlined in the local fiscal impact, starting on page 2. Estimated costs to the county auditors for adding an amendment to optical scan ballots is $69,000, and then programming and counting costs is $25,000. And then there's also printing and publishing costs. So the total estimated county cost would be $102,000. And then there would be additional costs depending on if there are other constitutional amendments that pass.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Roberts. And Mr. Shepard, do you want to walk us through the bill summary that you have to save on Representative Albright here?
Madam Chair and members, the first, just real briefly, the first section would propose the new state constitutional text that would add that the right of the people to be secure applies to electronic communications and data. The second section provides that the proposed amendment would be submitted to the people at the 2016 general election, and it states what the question would be that would be presented to the voters.
Okay. Members, any questions on the fiscal note or the bill summary as provided by nonpartisan staff? All right. And Representative Albright, do you want to add anything as we're waiting for Representative Scott to come to committee?
Madam Chair and members, I think the overview that has been provided by Mr. Shepard and others, I think, is fairly succinct. I would draw your attention to the bill summary for a couple of points that I think are important to just review. This is not something that has... where we're going it alone. The voters in Missouri also ratified similar language of a constitutional nature in 2014. This really goes to the point that I think we've all understood as the technological capabilities of this world expand globally, that we have to continuously redefine what personal property is, those devices and the data that is contained within them holds, and from a perspective of our constitutional rights, what protections we have under the law to defend undue search and seizure. So I'm certainly happy to answer any questions from the perspective that I did sign onto the bill as we wait for the chief author to arrive.
Well, thank you, Representative Albright, for pinch hitting. We do have some folks that are listed in wanting to testify to this bill. I've got Don Gemberling and Carl Eggers and David Arvidson. Mr. Gemberling, if you want to state your name for the record and who you represent.
So, Madam Chair, members, my name is Don Gemberling. And actually, in this particular situation, I don't represent anybody other than myself. So where it shows the Coalition on Government Information, which I do sometimes represent, that's not what I'm doing today because the Coalition hasn't taken a position. Some of you know that I've been working with privacy issues, transparency issues, and government accountability issues since 1973. I used to work for the state of Minnesota. For the last several years, I've been volunteering to advocate on these issues at the Capitol. So, the bill you have before you to establish a constitutional amendment in our Constitution to protect us against unwarranted searches of our electronic realities is, I think, one of the most important bills you have before you this year. Okay? And the reason for that is pretty simple. I'm not going to go into a long dissertation on constitutional history, but suffice it to say that one of the problems with constitutional interpretations is that they have a real difficulty catching up with technology. Technology is always running against the running ahead of the constitutional curve. And as the law of constitutional privacy has evolved over the last several years, actually the last 200 years, one of the clear gaps in that coverage is how the law handles searches of our electronic identities, okay? And that term may be strange to you, but keep in mind, in the modern world, we have an entirely different identity out in cyber land than we do in our actual persons, okay? I'll give you an example. For a number of reasons, I choose not to use the internet. I choose not to use email. Okay. However, I have a friend who cares less about these things than I do, so she lets me use her email. And so anything I do on that computer basically demonstrates that there's a very interesting person who uses that computer because they have very diverse interests ranging from civil liberties to fostering animals to looking for books to buy to doing tourist searches in the state of South Dakota, okay? Now, we all know, I think you all know, that everything we do on the internet is tracked by both the government and by private sector. And when it comes to issues of protecting what we do on the internet, for lack of a better word, protecting our cyber personality, Supreme Courts, both our local and the federal Supreme Court, struggle with what rights we really do have in that information. The best example I can give you is there's a long line of cases that basically says, and this may come as a shock to some of you, that when you put information out there on the net, when you use a variety of services, when the companies and other, for example, healthcare providers that you deal with create electronic information, our ownership rights in that information are very limited. Okay? Some people like to think that we own our bank records, we own our medical records, but my understanding of the law is that is not correct, okay? And the history of trying to deal with that issue over the last 40 years without going into great detail reflects that reality. Now, can a company give us ownership records, ownership rights in those records? Yep, they certainly can, but they rarely do. So one of the issues that's come up is, if you go to court and say, I think the federal government is trying to get at my phone records, and I don't think they should be able to do that without a warrant, you're going to get tossed out of court on the basis of what lawyers call standing. Because those records are not owned by you, because they're owned by the phone company, you don't have standing to challenge that warrantless search of your phone records. So that brings me to why this amendment is important. We need to acknowledge that technological reality and get on with having the opportunity through the Minnesota Supreme Court to develop how we're going to protect the privacy rights of Minnesota citizens to the extent that the information being sought by the government exists in electronic kinds of information. About a month ago, as I was thinking about this amendment, I opened some a mailing from my alma mater, William Mitchell College of Law, which announced that one of the nation's leading experts in this area was coming to William Mitchell to give a lecture on digital privacy. It's a guy named Edward Chemerinsky. He's from University of California at Irvine, and he's one of the leading scholars in the country on constitutional law and privacy. And he gave a wonderful presentation, the bottom line of which is, under current law, and as how he sees the law developing in this area, the only way we can absolutely try to protect people's privacy is by either statutory protection, which is done in a number of cases in this state, laws like the Medical Records Act and the Data Practices Act, or through constitutional amendments. Okay? And I sat there and quietly applauded. I wished I had taken notes that were more legible. I did provide those notes to Representative Scott and others because, you know, here was somebody who really is an expert. I'm a sort of expert. This guy is not only an expert, but he has huge academic credentials, who says that these kinds of initiatives by state legislatures are really needed. I thank you for your attention, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Gemberling. We all still have Mr. Eggers and Mr. Arvidson. If you want to come down to the table, we have a couple questions. Representative Johnson?
I'll wait till after testimony, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. And Representative Nelson, will you wait as
I'll wait till after you.
And Representative Earhart, you too?
I'll wait. Thank you.
Mr. Eggers? If you could please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you. My name is Carl Eggers. I'm with Liberty Minnesota, and we're a network of conservative and grassroots and liberty activists throughout the state of Minnesota involved in issues of individual rights and constitutional liberty. I thank you for allowing me and Representative Scott for having me speak today on behalf of House File 327. The most exciting part about this bill, beyond the constitutional ramifications and the data privacy ramifications, which are obvious in this bill, is the coalition behind this bill and this initiative. It's a broad coalition that you rarely find in 21st century America, much less in a state like Minnesota. You have my network of Liberty Minnesota, which is just a bunch of grassroots activists trying to stay engaged. You have the Republican Liberty Caucus, which I'm also a board member on, joining groups like the ACLU and the Tea Party, and the Occupy Minnesota movement, and the Libertarian Party, which is represented here as well. All those groups coming together behind this bill to support essential constitutional rights for the people of Minnesota. And as was stated earlier, the Constitution is usually behind technology, and this is an easy, simple amendment to the Minnesota Constitution, which would help our legal protection of existing 21st century life. Those groups that are fully and actively behind this legislation, we recently sponsored a poll conducted by Public Policy Polling, which showed 85% of Minnesotans support this protection. That's 85% of Minnesotans that cross the spectrum of political party, of gender, of age. Across through a variety of questions, it was similar between Democrat, Republican, men, women, the young, and maybe the not so young. We're all equally represented in their support of protecting their electronic data privacy. And when we asked the question of these groups of would you support amending the Constitution, the Minnesota Constitution, to protect electronic lives, 66% said they would. This is a common sense, no nonsense bill. It's quite easy. And it empowers the people of Minnesota to reinforce their constitutional protections, their Fourth Amendment rights, putting that into the Minnesota Constitution and extending that to their electronic lives. I appreciate the cost analysis, but I think that's a drop in the bucket for allowing the people of Minnesota to reinforce their constitutional rights. And I definitely would be willing to take any questions now or in the next few minutes.
And we have Mr. Arvidsson. Please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Good morning. My name is David Arvidsson. I'm the chair of the Libertarian Party for the state of Minnesota. I really don't have too much to add to all that. I thought it was pretty well said and pretty straightforward. I would like to say that if I mail something through the United States Mail or through FedEx or UPS, I expect the recipient of that to have it without any interference by government. We should all expect the same thing from our email, and items like this bill will help that in the future.
Okay,
and thank you very much for your time.
Is there anyone else wishing to speak to this bill? Welcome. Please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. For a great number of years, I've been before the legislative body on issues of privacy, civil liberties, and particularly electronic records over those years. Two things. The amendment that is being proposed is nothing new to the state legislative process across the country. Since the early 70s, a number of states have gone in and had constitutional amendments, both dominated Democratic states, Republican states, done on a bipartisan to let the people decide to update the privacy aspects of what they believe the Constitution is. And those states have done it. Here's an opportunity for Minnesota to do the same. And the second angle, and I think this is more of a historical perspective with a lot of institutional memory in this place. And I've been involved in a great many initiatives to try to get privacy protection in records of ourselves when held by third parties. But there's a lot of interest groups that will say no. And a lot of times, that is beat back. People do not have the opportunity. And there are many scenarios I can play out here for those to document that. By having a constitutional amendment, you are allowing the courts to develop the law to be able to give constitutional rights to people. One of the things, and I'll just say this particular case and I'll end. The Supreme Court has ruled, basically, there is no privacy interest in third-party records about you. That was a case nearly 40 years ago, and we're still relying on that case. The Minnesota Supreme Court is still relying on that case. So when these issues come up to the Supreme Court to sort of say, hey, I believe that there's a strong privacy interest, they're basing their decisions on 40-year-old law. We have to update our constitutional aspect of what privacy is, particularly in electronic records and third-party records that are held by other folks that we really no longer have control over. So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, those are my comments, and just from a broad kind of view, and that's why I'm so involved on these kinds of issues. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure what all was covered before I got here. I just wanted to point out that this would go in Article 1, Section 10 of the Minnesota Constitution. That article and section mirrors the federal Fourth Amendment. And you all have the language right in front of you. It's been stated the polling results and how many people favor a constitutional amendment such as this. And I want to state, too, that amending the Constitution is something that should never be done haphazardly. It should only be done when there are circumstances that strongly merit it. And I believe in this case, both on the federal level and on the state level, the people that designed both the federal constitution and the state constitution felt that our privacy was very important. They didn't think that government should be able to come in and go through our desk drawers and our closets and confiscate and use the papers and documents that they might find there. This proposal would just update our constitution, because now instead of having paper documents, which we still have some of. Much of what we do is done electronically, whether it's our bank records, it's our email back and forth with friends and business associates, or if it's even our medical records. A lot of that is done online now, and I think we need to have the highest of protections for that. With that, I guess I would take any questions. I think you probably already covered the fiscal note. I think it's $2,000. And with that, I would take any questions.
Great. Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize. I missed. Where is this matter going? Did you say it's going to the floor?
Thank you, Representative Johnson. And I can't remember if I did actually move it. I'm moving, and I'll do that right now, House File 327 to be referred to the Public Safety Committee. And any questions?
Yes. I guess even though it's not financial, since it's here, I'll just ask him anyway. I guess I'm all for the goal of the bill, but what I'm wondering is, will it in fact provide the clarity for the courts that you're apparently looking for? I guess it's somewhat of a rhetorical question. And to that extent, for me, it would be helpful to hear from more experts, constitutional lawyers, or people that could provide the other side of what the concerns are. I heard the proponents, and they make good sense, but I got a feeling if I heard people on the other side, they might make good sense as well. So that's probably my concern at this point, is I don't feel like I have a full understanding of the nuances of such a complex issue. And I guess as the bill moves forward, I'd like to see that sort of discussion occur at some level, if that makes sense.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And first off, I was under the understanding this was going to Ways and Means. That was what I was told yesterday, but we can talk about that. Secondly, there really haven't been a lot of, I don't remember in all of our testimony and committees that I've had somebody sit here and say that they're against it. Am I wrong? I don't remember having anyone come and say that they're against it. This same measure, same exact language, passed in Missouri by 75%. So there's really not a lot of opposition out there. I mean, I think people understand how common sense this is and how important it is. And that's why people just kind of get it and say, yeah, this it's a natural extension of our Fourth Amendment rights. So I don't know if that helps. And as far as the courts, putting this in the Constitution of Minnesota, I think is going to give the courts a pretty clear direction. The state of Minnesota in recent years hasn't had questions pertaining to this specific area. There have been cases on the federal level. There's a case, Jones, and let me find my notes on that real quickly. And it had to do with cell phone tracking, as I recall. I just went over those notes. I don't know if anybody else here knows Jones well enough to speak to it. Just had it here. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, okay. I'm thinking of Riley. Yeah. In the Riley v. California case, I have an article here. Well, actually, it's an email from the Missouri author of the bill. It says, the court considered two isolated instances in which police seized and searched the cell phone of an individual they had arrested. In considering both, the Supreme Court held that the respective officers had no business searching the cell phones without a warrant, but they did not discuss the general protection of communication or data as they exist electronically. So I think this is a question, another reason to put it in our Constitution to clarify for the courts that it's important to the people of the state of Minnesota, and that the rights of our personal effects should be extended to our electronic data and communications.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not necessarily disagreeing with you. I just think it's the kind of complex issue that needs a fuller airing than perhaps what has occurred, and I just think the people of Minnesota deserve to hear both sides, whatever they may be, in addition to what's been presented thus far.
Okay.
That's why we're here.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm going to repeat the, you know, the question I asked in government operations, that, you know, this constitutional amendment is a big deal, and Representative Scott basically said the same thing. And the curiosity, you know, with the speed at which computers are moving and computers changing and the methods are changing, doing a constitutional amendment is kind of a slow process that I don't know if it's going to keep up with the changing computers and the way we access them. And I guess I think of, as it was stated earlier, that it could be done statutorily or it could be done by the Constitution. I think the statutory way might give us a little more flexibility and a little quicker reaction time to when things happen, happen going forward, the changes that we don't foresee today. And the other question thing I have that just keeps getting brought up about this poll that was taken. I don't like it when I don't think we should be passing constitutional amendments based on polls that people have taken. I mean, I agree that privacy is an important issue, but if we're going to start legislating and changing our constitution based on polls, I think we can get in a real world of hurt there. I mean, at one point in our nation's history, if you polled the majority of the population, especially in the southern parts of the United States, it was okay, and they thought it was proper, and that the poll said it was okay to own another person. And we have changed those laws and those constitutions. And so, I mean, that's the concern I have with, you know, legislating by polls. Now, this is an important issue, but like I said, I think we could do it. We'd be better served if we did it legislatively with statute, and because I think we'd be more nimble if we did it that way.
Madam Chair, if I might just respond to that. And Representative Nelson, thank you for those comments. And you spoke to the fact that the people of Minnesota are not maybe fully aware and versed in this. And I would just say, do you think they're more fully versed in how legislators are paid or how they have how they want their own protections against illegal search and seizures? I think people understand this. It's not a rocket science sort of a thing. People know what their rights are in our country, and I think for a constitutional amendment, I don't think that there's gray area in this at all. I think it's easily understood, much more easily understood than how legislators are paid.
Representative Nelson?
Madam Chair, to answer that,
no.
Yeah, I think a lot of people in our districts think we're paid like they're paid in Congress, and I think they, in fact, people have expressed to me the doubt that why are you doing here? Aren't you supposed to be in Washington? They don't realize that we're here in St. Paul. So I don't know if that's an answer or not, but to the question. But like I said, I think we could do this statutorily. I think we'd be more nimble if we did it that way, that we could quicker address issues that would come up, and not do such a sledgehammer approach.
Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've got a couple of questions and sort of unrelated to the bill, but then I have a couple of questions about the bill. I'm always suspicious of Raleigh, North Carolina, and Virginia when it comes to cranking out stuff that's very focused on certain religious and other type of things. So who is it that is the organization at 3020 Highwood Boulevard in Raleigh, North Carolina?
Representative Earhart, that's the public policy polling. It's a national polling outfit. Hopefully that answers your question.
Well, it doesn't really tell me who's funding it, Madam Chair, and that's my curiosity.
This poll was purchased. Representative Scott, can you tell us who purchased the poll?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, I missed that question.
Could you tell us who purchased the poll?
Yes, if I could speak to that.
Mr. Eggers, please.
Yes, the poll was funded by Liberty Minnesota and the Republican Liberty Caucus, and we went through a well-respected polling firm, public policy polling, which is based out of Raleigh, North Carolina, and it was a survey of 500 Minnesota voters.
Representative Earhart.
Well, that tells you what I was trying to figure out. Madam Chair, it seems to me that this is an exercise in futility. I understand very little about the internet and the cloud and all this and that, but I do know that a hacker in Russia can expose everything that Target has on data, and personal data, and they could probably target me if they had any cause to and expose my data. And you can't do a damn thing about it by passing a constitutional amendment in Minnesota. In fact, if I'm in Wisconsin, I could do the same thing. Or if I was in Canada. So this is futile, absolutely futile. This is worldwide stuff floating around, and you're trying to contain it by doing a constitutional, even if you did a federal one, which would be a little broader in concept.
Madam Chair.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, and thank you, Representative Earhart. This is talking about what the government can't do and what the government can and can't seize of ours without a warrant. This has nothing to do with the private sector, and it has nothing to do with hackers being able to access our private data. This is about what powers does the government have over us.
I understand that. But, Madam Chair.
Representative Earhart.
The hackers can all get always also hack into our government data.
Right, but the hackers have no way of throwing us in jail or prosecuting us in a court of law.
Representative Earhart.
Well, I'm very naive about that, but if I was going to do some hacking and I was good at it, I could hack most anything that's available, including the highest security systems of the United States, and I could feed it to anybody that I wanted to. And it's being done and has been done, and I don't know how you're going to stop it by passing a constitutional amendment in the state of Minnesota. That's my point.
Okay. Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and either to the author Scott or the testifier. I'm assuming, looking at the language, and I like a one-page bill, by the way, this just deals with personal email. It wouldn't deal with, say, our legislative email, or if you are working for a company and have classified information or secure information. I'm assuming it just deals with private.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Detmer. This would deal just with persons, so any extension of the Fourth Amendment rights to us as individuals. And if I'm not mistaken, a person in the Constitution can be seen as a government entity too, so I believe they would still have to have a warrant if there was an accusation of criminal behavior within a company or an organization. But no, it would not. They'd have to have special to get it secure, or security information, or anything of that nature, especially if people had classifications, security classifications and stuff like that. It would, my understanding is that would it take special hoops to jump through.
Representative,
I don't know if anybody else has a different interpretation.
Okay. Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and this is one of the first comment I have is going to be pretty nitpicky, but on 1.1, line 1.10, I would believe you should delete the word "and" at the end of that line, just to make it grammatically flow. The other question I have is, before we change the Constitution and amend the Constitution, what is the current definition of effects? Because I would have to believe, from your example previously, that they found that the data on the phone was part of his effects and not searchable without a warrant. So would that, I believe that definition should be there. And I'm not saying I totally support the idea that electronic communications and data should be secure and not searchable without a warrant, but as I look at this, I would believe that my effects include that. Now, is there some definition to the contrary of that?
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Howe, as you look at the question in the bill, we are now secure from illegal search and seizure without a warrant in our persons, homes, papers, and effects. Those things are covered. Courts have been interpreting those for years, but I think those... I guess I would let maybe one of the testifiers answer that question in more legalese and specifics, but I think it's open, the effects and the papers, it's open for interpretation, and that's why we want to clarify that we believe that that is part, that the, that our personal communications and data are part of our effects.
Mr. Eggers, did you want to add a comment? And then Mr. Shepard, after he is done, I don't know if you have any knowledge on that. Okay.
Thank
Mr.
you.
Mr. Eggers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would defer to constitutional lawyers on the specific history of the definition of effects, but that is straight out of the Fourth Amendment, which has been argued for 240 years. That language in our Minnesota Constitution, as Representative Scott mentioned, is directly out of the federal Constitution, which states the rights of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable search and seizures shall not be violated without probable cause. So we'll leave the definition of each word in the federal constitution to the necessary parties, but I think adding that protection to electronic data and communications is essential in 2015.
Representative Howe.
Well, I am a little bit slow to amend any constitution, especially when it comes from our federal constitution, and we copied that. I think that's pretty, and I guess that's where I relate this to the same process that we're facing with, I think, Representative Winkler's bill. It's going to statutorily change a definition in our constitution, which I, at least you're going about it the right way, and you're not trying to statutorily change the definition of effects, which I think is what we're trying to do with Representative Winkler's bill, is we're going to statutorily change a definition of a term that's in our Constitution. So if we're going to do it, this is the right way to do it. I just, if it's been assessed in the past by other courts that effects includes electronic data, I guess I'm just a little reluctant to go ahead and change our Constitution when we've already kind of established through the courts that effects are, or electronic data is part of the effects. I'm a little cautious when we go forward with that.
Okay. Representative Kahn.
Well, I'm agreeing with the people and sympathetic to the problem. I'm agreeing with the people who think that we should go a statutory route rather than a constitutional route. And just looking at this, I think the easiest way is to put a definition, some definition of effects that would include electronic equipment. I do have a little bit of experience in this issue. I'm probably the only person who's been in court on this issue, specifically regarding the House, regarding the law that we passed on the use of state information systems for personal use. And if you read the arbitrator's report, I was the one who was responsible for the dismissal of charges against the Mankato football coach. So that was an example of taking electronic data gone amok. So I think we don't know exactly what's going to happen. I think the idea of going a statutory route rather than a constitutional route. And, I would just keep this bill here, actually, rather than pass it on.
Madam Chair, I think someone from the ACLU would like to just pop in.
Okay. We've got 5 minutes, and I do have some questions myself. So, briefly, if you could, please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ben Feist. I'm legislative director for the ACLU of Minnesota. I will keep this very brief. I did want to just jump in here. I was otherwise going to echo a lot of the support that this bill has, and to say that the ACLU also takes constitutional amendments very seriously. We shouldn't be messing with the Constitution lightly, but we believe that this is a very important way that we can expand rights rather than contract them, and therefore we are supportive. The issue here, or that's being discussed, I guess, is whether the Supreme Court has already acted on electronic communications and data. And I think the short answer is only in a very, very limited sort of way. In the Riley case that's been brought up, they're only talking about searching a cell phone incident to arrest. We do not know if the Supreme Court would feel the same about law enforcement searching my cell phone records just because they were interested in what I'm up to for an investigation that may someday lead to a prosecution and take away my liberty. The metadata, for example, it's been discussed on who you're calling, when you're calling, the patterns that can be connected is part of a big investigation as well, has not been addressed. In the GPS tracking context, we know that you need a search warrant to put a GPS device on a car and track them around. But we don't know, going to the context of the license plate reader technology, we don't know if using a license plate reader on every corner that effectively tracks where the car is at all times would also require a warrant. The Supreme Court simply hasn't gotten there because the rulings are very narrow and the courts are constantly looking at how they should be interpreting this. We see the idea behind this bill and this amendment as really being a value statement about what Minnesotans expect their privacy rights to be. And this will give some opportunity for clarity in the courts.
Great. Thank you. Representative Scott, I have some questions for you.
Sure.
So what happens to, how does this work with social media, things that people voluntarily post that are public? How would that work in this process?
Madam Chair, if it's out there in the public domain, it's basically, for lack of a better term, it's a free-for-all. If it's in the public domain, it's not considered your private effects.
And Representative Scott, what do you consider to be public domain?
I think anything that you're willing to state out there in the public domain on social media, since that was the context in which you asked me, but anything that the average person would be able to find out about you. I don't know, again, if there's anybody legally here that can speak to that, but certainly Facebook, Twitter, those sorts of things where you're putting out there knowingly in a public domain. You're not trying to protect that information. Whereas your medical records, who you call, where you go to the where you go during any given day, your banking information, that is you have a reasonable expectation of privacy with those items.
And Representative Scott, so when you say Facebook, say for example you have your Facebook set up so that only friends can read the information that you put out there, is that considered private data?
I don't know if it's classified currently in statute as private data. Well, I don't know if the courts have ever weighed in on that. It's a probably pretty reasonable question.
Under this amendment, how mm-hmm. would that be categorized?
One of the things that I think members need to consider is even when we have our Minnesota Constitution and we have a federal constitution, the courts are still the arbiters of a lot of the interpretation of that. And that's not going to be any different with this bill if it becomes law. There are still going to be court cases that establish the true meaning of these cases. So I don't know if Mr. Gimberling wants to weigh in, but I think the reasonable expectation of privacy is one of those litmus tests.
Well, and Representative Scott, I'm going to add one more piece to this. In addition to the Facebook side of it, we as individuals can make our Twitter only accessible to certain individuals that we invite. So then would that be considered public domain or is that considered private? How would it be defined under what this Constitution amendment is? And Mr. Gimberling, if you want to speak to that very briefly, we are at our 10 o'clock time and we will be moving on this bill.
Yep. Madam Chair, briefly, what the bill does is give the courts a chance to deal with and try and answer the very questions you're asking, okay? Because of issues like standing, in the current law, they're not even getting that opportunity. Because a smart lawyer goes in and says, you've given up your ownership of that data by putting it on Twitter, and therefore you don't have any ownership rights in the data, and therefore you can't challenge the government trying to get access to it. And in the process of legal cases, standing is something that comes up at the very beginning. Courts love standing arguments because they can dump complicated issues, and that's what's happening. So what all this does is give the courts the opportunity to address those kinds of issues.
But Mr. Gimberling, if I understand correctly, the courts are already doing that. They're already going through the process of defining what is what, correct? So separate from this, they're already doing that, correct? I'm just trying to get an understanding of what is this, how is this trying to define that data overall. So we are at the time that we need to get out of this room. Representative Kahn, did you have any follow-up questions?
I think we ought to keep this bill. I think this passed so quickly to us, I would feel more comfortable keeping this bill here and working on it longer instead of passing it on.
Thank you, Representative Kahn. I appreciate that. But the motion before us is taking House File 327 and refer it to public safety. And I'm going to renew my motion to do that. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
The bill moves to public safety. Thank you, Representative.
Can we have a division on that, Madam Chair?
I'd like to have a division.
Division. All those in favor of House File 327 going to public safety, please raise your hand. All those opposed? On 8-7, the bill moves to public safety.
Thank you,
Representative Scott.
How would Hillary Clinton feel about this bill?
You'll have to ask. With that, members, we are adjourned.